Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:09 p.m. and that's Pacific Summer Time on Friday, May 20th. And today was a pretty positive day on stock markets. The majority of indices in Europe were up over 1%. Majority of Asia was in positive territory. And despite the fact that we have had, it was really just this week, it was up one day, down the next on Wall Street. The S&P 500 is closing back above this 2050 area again. It's closing out the week at 2052. So then what we are presented with is that the dollar, which is now a kind of a barometer of risk, and we haven't seen anything like this really since 2011. And when, I guess this being Friday, there's the big picture long-term audio for the various asset classes. It's worth considering, where are we in the cycle? And at the chart seminar, we talk about the various things that you can see on charts and what is the best way to look at charts. And the number one lesson is to avoid myopia at all costs. And there are two forms of myopia in any market that any one person can experience. And of course, the first one is that we just look at too much short-term data. And then that clouds our understanding of where we are in the long-term cycle. But then there is another form of myopia, which is that we tend to focus our attention on the things that we own. So if you have a big position in bonds, you'll look at bonds. And then you'll look most particularly at the bonds that are in your portfolio. And if you have a short position in stocks, well, then you'll tend to think mostly about the most bearish of potential scenarios. And that is probably worthwhile thinking about right now, because the number of very bearish prognostications and I don't hesitate to say prognostication, because when we talk about trying to predict the future, there's an old market saying, which is that if you're going to predict, predict often. And it is obvious that none of us knows what's going to happen in future. What we can simply be guided by is what people are actually doing with their money, and the price action is the greatest arbiter of that. More than any other opinion, the price action is a fact. And the fact is that markets bottomed in 2009, and they bottomed because there was massive monetary accommodation. We were in the process of a major market crash, and you had a predictable, although it was an outsized, response from central banks. And it is worth considering that exact, what is it that central banks do? What is their number one job? And the number one job is to ensure that there is ample money within the system to promote economic growth. And the way they do that is that they look at how fast the money is moving around the system, and when it's moving very quickly, they can afford to take some of that money out of circulation, and when it's moving very slowly, they have to add money in. And the velocity of money in the USA has been declining since 1997, and one might say very clearly that there is a correlation there between the birth of the internet and its widespread adoption, and the decline in the velocity of money. And one simply has to look at the success that a company like Amazon has in disintermediation, that they have targeted a number of sectors and made them largely obsolete. And Apple has done the same thing, and so has Google. So then, because you've had this disintermediation where the number of steps in the supply chain has decreased, well, then the number of transactions would have to decrease, and that means that the velocity of money has gone down. And it's important because we have velocity of money data going back to the 1940s, and it's never been this low. And if that's the case, then if velocity of money has never been this low, then central banks are justified in having the supply of money at historic highs. But then the question is, what are they going to do with debt if that debt doesn't get progressively cheaper to issue? And then it is worth considering that every major crowd might be different in what it is investing in or what it is following, but every crowd shares similar characteristics, and one of the most acute of those is a tolerance for contradiction. So in the late 1990s, the contradiction in the market was that earnings don't matter. And before the credit crisis, it was that everybody can hedge all of their default risk. And right now, what we have, a contradiction in the market, is that very, very simple. It is that you can issue as much debt as you like and never have to worry about paying it back. Just another way, you never have to worry about the cost of refinancing it. And we have had record debt issuance in both the government and corporate bond sectors over the last 7 years. And the next point is that it is not yet ended. So there is still massive bond issuance, and that is equally the case among central banks and corporates. But that doesn't negate the fact that this is a potential problem, and that it is going to create the kind of stress that people really don't welcome, the majority of people don't welcome in their investment portfolios. But there is no evidence that that is actually happening right now. So when we look at, and I'm going to post a report today and a slideshow from, well, it's not a report, it's a transcript from a speech given by Stanley Druckenmiller, who is notably bearish, and he paints a very lucid picture and backs it up with a number of statistics for just about how much debt has been produced by corporations in the USA, by the governments of Europe, Japan, and China, and highlighting that this is going to represent a problem. But the big question from the perspective of an investor is, how likely is it that that is going to be a problem now? And the real problem when you have a large amount of debt outstanding isn't so much in the quantity of the debt, because the interest payments on the debt are generally quite small, but rather the problem is that what happens when that debt eventually expires and the principal has to be repaid. And then the question is, what is the cost of refinancing going to be? Well, the major central banks of the world have got trillions of dollars sitting on their, and trillions of euros and yen sitting on their respective balance sheets, and that represents paper that their respective governments have borrowed. And then the real question is not so much what the quantity of the paper is, but how well able are those governments going to be to refinance that debt when it comes due. And a substantial quantity of treasury debt comes due in 2018, 2019, and 2020. So that's when we're going to have some very large questions asked about the sustainability of the size of the Fed's balance sheet. Now, there are there are potential elegant solutions to this issue, but it would require quite a substantial quantity of cash being removed from the central bank's balance sheet. And then how likely is that to have a deleterious effect on a stock market, which has become, in many respects, addicted to liquidity? And that's where the problem lies, and that's, you know, the potential timeline for it. But the problem, and this is the question that is being asked by investors at the current juncture, and it is that if you take any addict, they start off becoming addicted by taking a small dose, and the longer they're addicted for, the greater the dose that they require just to sustain equilibrium. Well, we've been in a bull market which has been liquidity dependent since 2009, so that's about 7 years, and the quantities of liquidity required to fund share buybacks, to fund refinancing, and to fund dividend increases has increased commensurately with the scale of asset price inflation. And we are now in a more of a corrective environment. And we can see that on the charts. That's not a supposition. That's not subjective. That's totally objective, because we had a particularly consistent trending phase between about 2012 and 2015. And now the major Wall Street indices have been going largely sideways for over a year. And that tells us that supply and demand has come back into balance, and therefore the bullish and bearish arguments have come back into balance. So if we've elucidated what the bearish argument is, we should elucidate what the bullish argument is. And the bullish argument is that the Fed is not going to raise interest rates, that they are not going to be able to do that because you have negative interest rates everywhere else, that in fact the U.S. economy is not as strong as the Fed thinks that it might be, and therefore not that higher interest rates are not required, but rather lower interest rates are required and additional liquidity provision is necessary. And then therefore we can assume that if we're going to have additional liquidity, we'll have additional asset price inflation, and that this is nothing more than a range, and that we're going to have an upward break. And and that is largely what the bullish argument is in the short term. Now, if you're a veteran subscriber and you've listened to these audios before, you will know that we have a medium to long term bullish perspective on markets. That you don't simply complete a 13-year range and then move into a bear market, but rather that has more likely than not represented the beginning of a secular bull market, because that's exactly what we've had the last two times in the last 100 years that has happened. And that what we're now getting is the first big consolidation after a big bull market. Well, if that is the case, then we're going to need productivity growth. We're going to need corporate profitability to improve. And we're going to need valuations to deteriorate, and an end to financial leverage and financial engineering. And there is no blame to be attached to the fact that we've had a lot of financial engineering. And it's very, very simple that when interest rates are low, the argument for buying back shares is very compelling, because equity is a more expensive source of funding than bonds. So if you can get bonds cheaply, well, then you do that, regardless of what the price of the equity is, because you just you can borrow cheaply. So there is a cause and effect relationship. It's not really a decision at the board level. But where the problem really occurs is when the financial engineering takes precedence over longer term considerations, such as expanding the business or investing in research and development or making capital acquisitions. And you know, again, there is a certain amount of a cause and effect situation, that if you are benefiting your shareholders and stocks are going up and your financial engineering program is successful, and you just have to ask yourself, how often is it that you've been in an organization where the winning strategy is questioned while it's still continuing to make progressively more money? And certainly not in any organization I've ever been a part of. Rather, it's the opposite occurs, is that when a winning strategy is successful, the person who has been promoting it is trotted out and extolled as somebody that other people should emulate. Then when we look at stock markets, we are in this rangy environment overall on Wall Street, and we are at the upper side of that range. And this 2050 area is really just about where prices have been finding support over the last couple of weeks. But if this is just the unwinding of the short-term overbought condition from that very impressive rally that we had from the January lows, well, then it has been very tight in terms of the consolidation so far. And there is potential that we are in a more risk-on and risk-off environment. And the dollar index, or the dollar, is an arbiter of that. And the dollar had got all the way down to test the lower side of its range. And that had also broken out of a long-term range. It's now moved into a process of consolidation. And it has now posted a failed downside break. And in the process, it unwound the short-term oversold condition. So there is room for the dollar to consolidate and to pause a little bit in just to allow that short-term overbought condition to be unwound. But in an environment where the Federal Reserve is talking about normalizing interest rates and just about everywhere else is talking about increasing their monetary accommodation, then there are very clear tailwinds for the dollar. And when we look at what those are, then the USA has a technological advantage, and particularly in software and healthcare. And then the entrepreneurial seedbed for so many corporations remains Silicon Valley, and there's a massive concentration of private equity wealth located in the Bay Area. And that represents just a phenomenal source of value creation. Well, of course, it's also the USA is also by far the largest economy, and the banking sector has responded really very favorably this week, in particular, to the increasing supposition that the Fed is going to raise rates in June or July. And of course, the Fed has been promoting that that supposition over the last week or two. Then, if we look at the dollar, that it has steadied a bit, then that has taken some of the wind out of what has been a spectacular rally in commodities. But commodities have been trending lower for 4 years. So they have now broken, the vast majority of at least, have broken their progression of lower rally highs and are susceptible to some consolidation. But then because this is also something that is worth considering from the perspective of the cycle, in that it is, generally speaking, the resources sector that underperforms in the middle of the cycle and then turns to outperformance in the latter stages of a bull market. And the reason for that is, generally speaking, a central bank won't raise interest rates until the economy is doing better. And if the economy is doing better, then they will feel more secure in raising interest rates. That acts as a headwind for the rest of the market. But because commodities are generally more leveraged to global growth than specific growth within any one country, then they tend to do better and outperform and are responding more to the pickup in growth than the pickup in interest rates. And that is what we are looking at right now, that we have had a substantial rally, and particularly in gold shares and in miners, and indeed in the energy sector. And all of those sectors were absolutely benighted last year and have turned to outperformance this year. So yes, we are presented with short-term overbought conditions, and there is the potential that they are going to pull back and consolidate, and that is likely to represent a buying opportunity from a medium-term perspective. But we certainly wouldn't be looking at the resources or the energy sector as lead indicators for what's going to happen on the wider market. We would anticipate that they actually outperform the market well past the peak, and that they'll be among the last sectors to eventually roll over. What we really do should be looking at is looking at some of the sectors that did lead the wider market, and that is particularly the biotech sector, which has pulled back very sharply but has found at least short-term support over the last couple of weeks. And it looks to me at least that we're in a corrective environment, but this isn't an environment that's going to characterize a top like we saw in 2008 or 2000. But is it going to be more choppy, more difficult, more volatile? I think we've already had evidence that that is the case, and there is no great deal of, there's nothing to suggest that we're not going to have a continued difficult environment. Now, Europe is trading at a substantial discount to the US, and we have this uncertainty about the Brexit vote coming up in June, and I think following that, and we're likely to have a positive outcome from that referendum, then there's potential for Europe to play catch up in here, and not least because the ECB is probably around where the Fed was 3 or 4 years ago, that they've engaged now in a process of quantitative easing, and they're not going to stop until they get the result that they want. And it's pretty similar for Japan. Japan has obviously got a massive debt to GDP ratio, and that's a significant challenge, but at the same time they have a current account surplus, and they hold the majority of their debt in domestically. So the Bank of Japan has ample potential here to further ease policy. And China has a substantial non-performing loans market and has been engaged in stimulus. And considering that they do look like that they want to press ahead with additional rationalization of overcapacity, in particularly in the infrastructure and resources sectors, then it's very unlikely that they're going to tighten monetary policy while they're doing that, because it would be madness to do anything other than to remain or to continue to have easy monetary policy, because the economy is just going to need that assistance. Well, when you have so many central banks printing money, then that is likely to act as a continued tailwind for markets. And it isn't really until we have the ability of companies to refinance debt, at least I suspect that that is likely to be a major catalyst. But it's not likely to be a major catalyst this year. And that suggests that we are susceptible in the short term to some additional weakness, but that that's likely to represent a medium-term buying opportunity. Because, yes, valuations have we have had valuation expansion, but we're not at bubble valuations. Where we are is we have bubble debt levels. And that is certainly a consideration. And I think that, if you are looking for risk in the market, you're looking for a contradiction and something to monitor, then that really is where we have to monitor. But when we're monitoring it, we have to also just read the lesson or read what the market is telling us. And it is that, yes, yields are going up on the short end of the curve, but there is ample demand at the long end of the curve. We're definitely having a flattening of the yield curve, but we're certainly not an inverted yield curve. And an inverted yield curve is something to be very wary of, because it's been a reliable lead indicator for recessions with about a 12 to 18 month lead time. And that would suggest then that we're still in a short-term corrective environment, but that's what it is. It's a short to medium-term corrective environment, not a long-term corrective environment. And that we are getting productivity growth from technological innovation, from the fact that energy prices are unlikely to get back to the highs that we saw in the last few years, and that we're into on average, a much lower energy price environment going forward, and that by and large governance is improving, and particularly in major commodity population centers. And that is likely to represent a significant bullish phenomenon. And not least because a large number of emerging market currencies have already been through lengthy processes of devaluation, and that that process of devaluation, I think, has probably ended, and that we're into a more stable period of time. And then the competitiveness that those economies will have garnered is going to start to come through in terms of their economic performance over the next couple of years. So I don't think it's the time to becoming progressively more bearish of emerging markets, but rather to look on them as potential opportunities, and not least because they've had the valuation contraction that we have not yet had on some of the more expensive developed markets. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.